The last time we were together, we were in Galatians chapter 4, and we were in the paragraph that starts in verse 21 and goes through the end of the chapter. We're actually winding up the last paragraph that has to do with the major thesis of chapters 3 and 4, which has to do with justification by faith as opposed to law. So what has happened is, in this last paragraph, he's raised an issue of the message of the law. He said in verse 21, "Tell me, you who want to be under law, do you not listen to the law?" And that the very strong implication is that the message of the law has been missed, and they're not hearing what it has to say to them, in spite of the information that he's dropped on them in chapters 3 and 4. With this understanding, they got this letter, and it was read through, probably for them, by whatever leadership they had, because that's the way the letters were handled. They didn't make Xerox copies and pass them out. It was a standard procedure, as far as I understand, in the synagogue in those days, that they would read the scriptures as a part of their public time together. And so I'm assuming that the church picked that same pattern up, since they didn't have printing presses and iPads and all that stuff. So when he says, "Do you not listen to the law?" he's assuming that they haven't assimilated the information, they just heard it. So he's pointing backwards to their penchant for being drawn into a legal framework or mindset in their relating to God, apart from the information that he's given them in these two chapters. But at this point, he is asking them if they really understand the message of the law. What is it actually saying? And of course, we've spent months and years now looking at the details. So for us, we have to go back quite a ways, time-wise, to get back into chapter 3 where the message of the law is. You know, cursed is everyone who is under the law, because the law says cursed is everyone who doesn't keep all the commandments, and nobody does. So the message is a message of a cursing. And they didn't have the luxury we have of months and years to ponder the words. They just were hearing it the first time. But anyway, what we've been doing is we've been working our way into this paragraph, and in our last study, we considered the issue of what Paul meant when he wrote that the son of the bondwoman was born according to the standard of the flesh. And we basically examined this whole idea of what the standard of flesh is. And we saw that the bottom line is that it's man's attempt to fulfill his or her desire to be God in God's place, to be the one who does the things that are supposed to bring about the results that everybody is trying to obtain. In Abraham's case, Abraham and Sarah both wanted a son so bad they could taste it. But they had been denied the fulfillment of that desire all of their married life, and they were very well advanced in age. Abram at this time was, at the time of the allegory here, was 86 years old. So he'd been put on hold for a while. The point being that because he had this desire and Sarah had this desire and God had even promised them the fulfillment of that desire, but it was initially Sarah's idea, but Abraham bought into it. It was their attempt to take over God's prerogative of fulfilling the promise his way and his time and making their own way and time. That's the essence of the flesh, man's attempt to fulfill the desire to be God, in the sense that God means the executor of power. And when God exercises power, he always does it in view of the big plan that he's been revealing from back in Genesis. There is a grand plan, and that means that creation's moving toward an ultimate achievement. And that there was a child born to a bondmaid under this standard of the flesh, means that Abraham had taken the bit in his teeth in terms of the grand plan, at least in terms of how. Because how God will work out his grand plan is the big issue. I mean, that's the question of faith that everybody runs into. As soon as something goes wrong from their perspective, they wonder, how can this be the will of God? The big issue of faith is always, how? What's going on here, and how can this be a reflection of the grand plan? And there's more unbelief that floats in Christian circles around that idea than anything, because we still want to be in control. We still want to call the shots, and we want to be the executor of power. But that's God's job. The real issue in the text is not what God is trying to accomplish. That's a given. He's already declared that Abraham's going to have a son, and in the larger scheme of the grand plan, that son was going to be the progenitor of the coming Messiah, who would then be the Redeemer and make it possible for human beings to take part in God's master plan. So we know that that's what God is trying to accomplish, but Abraham and Sarah had already decided that they would accomplish it in a different way because God wasn't working according to their schedule. The standard of flesh invariably posits multiple false issues. The first and most corrupting is misidentifying the ultimate achievement that creation exists to bring to pass. Ultimate achievement, the chief end of man thing. Because the standard of flesh will invariably posit a different chief end of man, reason why God created humanity, than the Bible does. The standard of flesh always does. It corrupts that. And that, because it's so fundamental to the question of all of the rest of the questions of our lives. What is God doing? What is his goal? What does he desire to accomplish? So if we can corrupt the desire of God's accomplishment at the fundamental level, then we can corrupt a lot of things. And the second most corrupting influence, hard on the heels of the first one, is the misimplementation of a workable means to the end. If you misidentify the end and you misimplement the means to that end, you've got a royal mess on your hands. You can just destroy enormous numbers of things by pointing people to the wrong end and getting them to apply the wrong means to that wrong end. And that's what Sarah basically suggested to Abraham, is that they apply a wrong method. The third false issue is invariably a deceitful follow-up of the false means with a rational explanation so that it sounds good. Abraham failed in the realm of faith by switching over to the standard according to the flesh. He identified the possession of a son as a greater objective than God's ultimate achievement. In other words, for Abraham, having a son was the be-all, end-all, that was it. That's all. I'm sure that when he thought about having a son, he had in mind things that he wanted to do with his son and the joy that having a son would bring and all. But basically, he had boiled life down to, I don't have a son. I want one. That's what he had boiled life down to. And in the big scheme of things, that's kind of silly to misidentify and posit put such a huge weight on something that's not that huge. So he had succumbed to the temptation of exalting his own desire above the desire he had for God's plan. And then the second thing he did was he implemented a process to obtain that son that was in direct contradiction to divine revelation. You can't fault somebody at the level of faith until you understand that faith is a response to divine revelation. If God hasn't said anything, you have nothing to believe. Faith means that God has revealed. You know what to expect. That's why you believe. The issue, for example, that was raised a week or so ago for me, a guy asked me, what do you think about this thing about Cain offering the work of his hands you know, Abel offered the lamb or whatever, and Abel's offering was better. And I said, well, Hebrews 11 says that Abel by faith offered a better sacrifice, which means that God had told them what to offer. And that means that Cain was disobeying. He wasn't just not believing, he was disobeying divine revelation. Well, the same thing's true here. Abraham did not invite Hagar into his bed without being in contradiction of divine revelation. He knew better than to do that if he had thought about it. And then he failed at the level of faith in the third step by allowing his behavior to be described as legitimate both before and after the fact. Sarah said, maybe this is God's method. And then afterwards he told God, let Ishmael be the one. So he was still pushing this unbelieving approach. So that's the standard according to the flesh. Misidentify the objective, misimplement the means, and then justify yourself. That's the flesh. So the standard of flesh will always be man attempting to take over God's place by means of a false goal, false method, and false explanation, both before and after the fact. That's the standard according to the flesh. Men will always do that if they're motivated by the flesh. Now, in the text, it says in verse 24 that this standard of the flesh and son through a promise is an allegory. And in our reference to the allegory, it's my conviction that Paul uses allegory as a confrontation of the false explanation, especially after the fact. We need to be clear on what he means when he calls this an allegory, because he's attempting to correct the Galatians' descent into falsehood at the level of explanation. That's what Galatians is. It's an explanation. So we're going to be exposed to the details of a birth that is according to the standard of flesh and a birth that is through promise. That was verse 23. We're going to be exposed to the details of those in this allegory. And this evening what we're going to do is look into Hagar as the classic illustration of a mother whose children are born into slavery. Because that's what it says in verse 24. This is allegorically speaking. These women are two covenants, one proceeding from Mount Sinai, bearing children who are to be slaves. She is Hagar. Now, the fascinating thing about use of allegory at this point is the theological implication. Allegory is taking a valid historical reality and illustrating theology from it or by it. That's what Paul is doing. Paul is saying, look, you look at Hagar, you look at Sarah, you look at Ishmael and Isaac, and you will see theology at work in history. And that's the thing I want us to be as clear as we can be on. History follows theology. And bad stuff happening in history is always the outworking of bad theology at the beginning. And even people who don't think that they think about God do think about God. They have their own theology, even if it's God is dead. I mean, that's a theological statement. Even if they say, well, God's not interested in me, that's a theological statement. If they say, there is no God, that's a theological statement. If they say, the God that is not interested in the things that are going on, that's a theological statement. You cannot get away from the fact that everybody has a theology, and it is the error of thought at that level that creates all of the rest of the mess. So, history follows theology. If it's true, it works in history. If it's not true, it blows up in history. And that's what Paul's point is. These things happened in history as an illustration of reality, as it is declared by God as true. Allegorically speaking means Hagar represents some things. So that's what we're going to be looking at this evening. Hagar is a representative. According to verse 24, she is a representative of one of two covenants. She is a representative of that covenant that proceeded from Mount Sinai, bearing children who are to be slaves. She is the representative of that reality. So we're going to start with the fact that she is a representative of the covenant from Sinai that produces slaves. And we're going to start with Hagar as a representative of a covenant. Back in chapter 3, verse 15, we looked at the fact that a covenant is a way that even men recognize as a method to ensure a minimum of conflict after it's confirmed. The whole point of a covenant, Paul said in chapter 3, that even men subscribe to, is that you enter into a covenant in order to minimize the downline complications of human relationships. You agree ahead of time what the boundaries are and what the methods are going to be and all of that. You agree ahead of time. You confirm the thing. And then 2 months from now, when you realize what you agreed to and you don't like it anymore, tough, it's settled. Live with it. That's what covenants are for. They're to establish the way it's going to be. And back there in chapter 3, he argued that there was a covenant that God made with Abraham. And then 430 years later, there was another covenant that was made on Mount Sinai. And that the covenant of law does not replace the prior covenant. They have different purposes and they exist in a different time frame for different reasons. But as a covenant, what it means is that Hagar represents a confirmed agreement that will ensure its intended purpose. So Hagar represents the covenant from Sinai. She represents the fact that the covenant from Sinai will accomplish its purpose. Properly understood. When the covenant from Sinai was established and confirmed, it was a foregone conclusion that it would accomplish the purposes for which it was confirmed. The problem, of course, is that men didn't understand what the purposes were, in spite of the fact that God told them. But nonetheless, we hear what we want to hear. So, the issue then is Hagar represents a confirmed agreement that's going to pan out the way it was set up. It will accomplish its intended purpose. And that characterization of Hagar as a covenant means that Hagar has a downline place in God's grand plan that does not in any way subvert any and every previous ratified covenant. In other words, what Hagar did, what she represents in history as a theological construct, it's a confirmed covenant. She's a confirmed covenant representative, and her example and presence will not undercut the previous ratified covenants. In other words, God made a covenant with Noah that the rainbow was a guarantee that the whole world would never be flooded with water again. All right? Hagar's presence in history, her giving birth to a son of Abraham, Ishmael, was not going to make the world get flooded again. Couldn't happen. That covenant was ratified way before that, and she's downline from it. So she can't affect that. She can't erase it. Then God made a covenant with Abraham. And in that covenant, he promised him a land, a seed, and a great name. And Hagar's giving birth to Ishmael is not going to keep that from happening. It's going to mess things up big time in some ways, but it is not going to subvert the prior covenant. What Hagar represents in history is not a subversion or a reason to be filled with dismay. She is a covenant, but she does not erase the prior ones. That Hagar existed as a representative of a later covenant that does not subvert the former ones means that God has a particular objective for the covenant that is Hagar. Hagar represents the covenant from Mount Sinai. And as such, she illustrates a reality that is sufficiently important as to require a formal covenant. Hagar as a covenant means that she takes her place in history according to the grand plan of God, without any ability on her part or on her covenant's part to undo the previous commitments that God has made to men who have believed Him. I want you to be aware of this reality. And issue of promise and faith. When God makes a promise and a man believes him, God is absolutely going to fulfill what he has promised to that person who is believing. And that's going to happen regardless of whether that person's faith stays strong or not. In other words, that Abraham failed in faith at this point in his history is beside the point. If God had made a conditional covenant with Abraham that depended on his continuance in faithfulness, then the whole thing would have been a covenant set up so that it could fail. But that wasn't, the Abrahamic covenant wasn't a two-sided covenant. You remember back there it said that God is one. He's the one who made the commitment to Abraham. He didn't tell Abraham he had to do anything to get these promises. He just got them. God just gave him the commitment. He made the covenant. And when Abram said, how can I know that this is really going to be the case? God went through a formal covenant arrangement where he split these animals. He had Abraham split these animals in half, and he went through a formal confirmation of a covenant in which he told Abraham, if I don't keep my word to you, you can do to me what you've done to these animals. It isn't going to happen. And because of that, it doesn't really matter what Abraham does in terms of whether God's going to keep his word or not. He's going to keep his word. It's his integrity that's at stake. So that's the issue here with Hagar as a covenant, as a representative of the covenant from Sinai. She does not undercut the previously ratified covenant. And in terms of practical application, what that means is that as believers in the new covenant, the one that Jesus established with his blood, as believers in that covenant, not even our disobedience and unbelief will undercut the promise that God has made to us in that covenant that we have believed in. It's his integrity that's at stake. Ours is already shot. He didn't rest it on ours. He knows what that's worth. So Hebrews says it this way, having no greater to swear by, he swore by himself. And he added to promise an oath so that we would have these strong reasons to believe him. If he rested it on us, sure, we could be antsy. But he didn't. He rested it on himself. So as a covenant, that's what she represents. Secondly, the particular covenant that she represents is the one that was confirmed at Sinai. That's what verse 24 says. She is the one proceeding from Mount Sinai. Well, the issue of the covenant from Sinai, we all know that's the law of Moses, okay? There's a lot of information about the law of Moses in the scriptures, but I think the interesting thing here is the reference to it as the covenant from Mount Sinai. Because Mount Sinai, it has a large Old Testament history and place in the theology of the Old Testament as it developed. But in the New Testament, Sinai is only used in the New Testament twice in Acts and here in Galatians. That's it. And it's used in Acts chapter 7 in the sermon that Stephen preached just before they stoned him to death. Made him so angry, they killed him. Part of what made them so angry is what he said about the covenant from Sinai. Because he says in Acts 7:30 that it was in the wilderness of Sinai that Yahweh appeared to Moses at the burning bush at the point when Yahweh was setting his plan of deliverance of the nation from slavery into motion. He showed up at the burning bush to get the man that he was going to send to Egypt to deliver his people from their slavery in Egypt. That was the whole idea. He appeared in the wilderness of Sinai for the express purpose of getting his deliverer on the site to deliver the people so that they could come out of their slavery, come out of their bondage. So Sinai has that idea that it was that in the wilderness of Sinai that God expressed his plan to deliver people into freedom. But it was in Acts 7:38 that Stephen also said that it was at Sinai that the angelically rooted covenant. Remember, Paul said this came through angels. It was established and it produced living oracles that Israel refused in their hearts so that they could, at least in their hearts, return to Egypt. It was in the wilderness of Sinai that the nation of Israel rejected the living oracles. They rejected the freedom that God wanted to bring them to. They said, enough of this freedom stuff. We're thirsty, we're hungry, and we wish we were back in Egypt. Well, that's a rejection of the freedom and going back into the slavery, at least at the heart level. It's easy and convenient to forget how much they whined and complained and cried out to God and bitterly wept over their bondage in Egypt. I mean, they forgot all about it. We'd rather be back in Egypt. Oh, yeah, back there where you were whining and crying and carrying on and going on and on about how horrible life is and all the, we want to go back to that. Yeah, right. But that's what they were doing in Sinai. And so at the very point of God's plan to deliver them, they rebelled, turned against the living oracles. And that means that when you take these two references outside of Galatians to Sinai in the New Testament, those emphatically refer to the issue of slavery as an issue of the agency that Israel both hated and loved. It's a classic illustration of the divided heart and the absence of the joy of life. Israel wanted to be free, but they wanted to be free on their own terms. And if they couldn't have it on their own terms, they wanted to go back to what they had before, which was bondage. So they had this divided heart. They wanted to be free, but they didn't want to be free, if that's just what it was going to mean. So, the whole idea of Sinai is this idea that God had a plan to deliver His people, but when they came out into the wilderness and they began to complain about everything and want to go back to Egypt, God brought them to Mount Sinai and He gave them a covenant that they broke before Moses ever got off the mountain. People often think that Moses broke the commandments that God had inscribed in stone. He broke the tablets in a fit of anger. Well, yeah, he was angry. But what he did when he broke the covenant stones, when he broke those tablets of stone, was he was saying, you folks have already broken this covenant. I just got it. So it was a historical illustration of what they had just done. Point being, God has freedom in mind, but in order to get there, we're going to have to deal with the issue of law. That's why Paul said that the law was a tutor, verse 24 of chapter 3, to lead us to Christ. Something has to get us to the point where our desire for freedom also fits with the plan for freedom. So Hagar as Sinai means that she will fit the bill of Paul's allegory of the antagonism that men have toward God, which is the essence of the standard according to the flesh. Hagar is a representative of antagonism toward God. Yahweh wanted to deliver His people. His people wanted to be delivered from Yahweh. Yahweh wanted to deliver His people from Egypt, but they wanted to be delivered from Him. That's why they wanted to go back to Egypt. They wanted some God that Aaron would create for them out of gold. They wanted to be delivered from the God of Sinai, but He wanted to deliver them from slavery. And she stands as the classic example of man's deeply rooted antagonism toward Yahweh as the true God. Bottom line, men hate God. Hagar is an illustration of that antagonism. She is the representative of the covenant at Sinai. And the essence of the covenant at Sinai, Paul said, was to reveal man's sin, his antagonism and hatred toward God that caused him to act like he acts. So she was representative of a covenant. She's a representative of that covenant that exposes man's hatred for God. And thirdly, she's a representative of the covenant that produces children that are enslaved. Verse 24 says she's bearing children who are to be slaves. The law of Sinai was a slave-producing covenant. It was not a freedom-producing one. It was a slave-producing one. That's what the Jews never could get in their heads. They thought that if they had the law, they could be free. Jesus said, you search the scriptures because you think that in them you have life, but you won't come to me. So, they thought they could be free by that covenant, but that covenant said, no, you're not going to be free. Under me, you're going to be dead. You're going to be enslaved to your sin. That's the whole idea of producing bondage. The verb that describes Hagar's activity in terms of producing or bearing children, that's the conception birth issues, means that whatever's born from her will be a slave. Because she was a slave. So she represents this idea that with her as the covenant of antagonism toward God, the children are going to be antagonistic toward God. They're going to be slaves. And the fundamental issue is bondage. This idea of being an abject slave in its negative sense. We've already talked about how the biblical writers characterize themselves as the servants of God, slaves of God. That's a positive spin. But there is a negative aspect to slavery, or God would have never wanted to deliver his people from it. It's a negative thing when it comes to Hagar. And the issue of bondage is the experience of enduring incremental loss without any kind of resolution toward joy. You are in bondage when your experience is incrementally getting worse and worse and worse, and you see no way out. That's bondage. And both freedom and bondage have far more to do with the internal state of a person's heart, mind, and spirit and soul than with his external circumstance. It's in your head that you're in bondage. It's in your heart that you're in bondage. Not because somebody can tell you what to do, make you do it. It's the way you think about their ability to tell you what to do and make you do it. It's the way your heart responds to their ability to give you orders and make you do things or suffer the consequences. Just let me be real clear here. Nobody can ever make you do anything if you don't want to do it. The only way you can be forced to do something you say you don't want to do is by them saying, well, I'm going to do something to you that you do not want to happen. And so you better do that or I'm going to do this. If you're willing to accept the consequences, nobody can ever make you do anything. No human person. That's why Jesus said, don't be afraid of those that have control over your physical things. Bondage is a matter of the mind and the heart and the soul and the spirit, not the external circumstances. If you're willing to die, nobody can make you do anything because the worst thing they can do is kill you. They can torture you. Well, if you're afraid of torture, then yeah, you can be forced to do all kinds of stuff. But it's your willingness to be forced that way that gives them that leverage. Nobody can make you do anything that you don't want to do in the final analysis because bondage is in your mind and in your heart. And being in bondage by linkage to the issue of covenant means that you're outside of the activities of the God of promise. So that you cannot by any personal means get into the blessing of God. That's what bondage is. You are enslaved by the way you think and the things you value. You see no way out. And you can't get out on your own. You're outside of the promises. That's why Paul said, remember that you were once aliens, alienated from the life of God. So the bondage is, finally, theological and real. Because it's the way men think that make them bound or free. And theology is the root of every bit of human thought. The way you think about God governs everything else you think about. and therefore bondage is theological. Hagar, as a producer of children in bondage, is a representative of the descent into grief without remedy. She's a covenant. She's a covenant of Sinai. She's a representative of children in slavery. And then finally, she's Hagar. What I mean by that is Hagar is as Hagar, not as a covenant, not as a covenant from Sinai, not as a covenant from Sinai bearing children to slavery, but she's Hagar. Well, what does that mean? Well, when you read this paragraph, you'll discover that Hagar and Isaac are identified by name. Sarah and Ishmael are not. I take that to mean that the names mean something. So when I got to looking at Hagar as the woman who was named Hagar, the name, I found some things out. First of all, the name means either flight or one put to flight. And that's in our context. What does the scripture say? It says in verse 30, cast out the world through the unbelieving stumble of a man who was supposed to trust what God said to him. And that means that there is a larger picture, and that is of the adversary's skill in making use of the failures of faith to corrupt the divine plans, inasmuch as it's possible to do so. Hagar became an inserted thorn whose presence created a festering sore that has erupted into the present-day Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Who would have thought that a gift from Pharaoh in the form of a bondmaid to a man who had lied to Pharaoh about his wife's identity would create the mess we're living with now? Who would have thought it? But that's the whole point. And that's the issue, because in this paragraph it says that what will happen is, in verse 29, at that time he who was born according to the standard of flesh persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit. And that's the way it is now. And it still is now, 2,000 years later. The children of Islam are still persecuting the offspring of Isaac. It's theology being followed by history. That's why he calls it an allegory. It's going to work this way, because this is the way it is. So, that's what I wanted to look at this evening, because the issue here, the focus, from verse 23 down through 25, the focus is all on Hagar, the mother of the son who was born according to the standard of flesh. So obviously Paul wants the Galatians, and by extension, he wants us to understand the dynamics of this whole issue of what happens when we trust God